From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In her poetry and prose, Claribel Alegría writes of the loss of lives in the wars of Central America, as well as the loss of spirit and culture. Her writing and her convictions have forced her to flee her native El Salvador. On today's Fresh Air, I talk with poet Claribel Alegría. Also today, thrill-crazy teens and the sin-steeped story of today's beat generation. Michael Barson tells us about his new book that reprints posters that promoted the great trash films of the 50s. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the debut album of a marimba and violin duo. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Whoopi Goldberg's stand-up act. That's all coming up on this edition of Fresh Air. Poet Claribel Alegría cannot return to her home in El Salvador. That would be too dangerous. But in her poetry, she evokes the sounds and smells of her country. In exile, she writes about her friends who have been killed or tortured, and of babies mutilated by soldiers. In 1978, she won Latin America's most prestigious literary award, the Casa de las Américas Prize. Alegría was born in Nicaragua in 1924. Her father fought against the U.S. Marines there, and when she was 1 year old, her family moved to El Salvador. She first left El Salvador to attend college in the United States. While in school, she met Darwin Flakel, who later became her husband, and eventually collaborated with her on books about El Salvador and translated her poetry into English. Over the past 35 years, they've lived in several Latin American and European countries. Recently, they've been dividing their time between Managua, Nicaragua, and Mallorca, Spain. Claribel Alegría's most recent books are Luisa in Reality Land, a memoir about her childhood which combines prose and poetry, and a new book of poetry titled Woman of the River. I asked her to read a poem.
We were three, Tupaco and Rodolfo. It was winter. There was snow. It was night. This is a green day of doves and sun, of ashes and cries. The wind pushes me across the bridge, over the cracked earth, through a dry stream bed strewn with cans. Death comes to life here in the ya, the torrente, the stone bridge. My dead weight at every corner, the innocent grill work of balconies, the film mirror of my dead. They smile from the distance and wave to me. They leave the cemetery, a wall of the dead. My flesh emits light, and they come to my door waving their arms. The bridge was a stone, it was night. Our arms circle each other, we sway to our songs. Our breath rose from our mouth in a small, crystalline clouds. It was winter. There was snow. We were three. Today, the earth is dry and resounds like a drum. My arms fall to my sides. I am alone. My dead stand watch and stand signals to me and send signals to me. They assail me in the radio and paper. The wall of my dead rises and reaches from Aconcagua to Izalco. The bridge was a stone. It was night. No one can say how they died. Their persecuted voices are one voice, dying by torture in prison. My dead arise. They rage. The streets are empty, but my dead wink at me. I am a cemetery. I have no country. And they are too many to bury.
Claribel Alegría, when was the last time that you were in El Salvador?
I was there in January of 1980.
And
for the last time.
Why haven't you been able to go back since then?
Because in March of 1980, Monsignor Romero was assassinated. I remember very well I was in Paris when I heard the news. I had been invited to the Sorbonne to give a reading of my poems. And instead of giving a reading of my poems, I talk about the assassination of Monsignor Romero. And I felt, and like me, many others felt, that we had to do something to fill the vacuum, the great vacuum that Monsignor had left in El Salvador. And so I decided to go ahead and write and denounce what was happening in El Salvador. And since then, of course, it's very dangerous for me to go there.
Are your books in print in El Salvador?
Yes, now there are. For a long time, there weren't any except one, Ashes of Izalco, a novel that my husband and I wrote, a historical novel, that by sheer ignorance of the people of the government was let, you know, to be to serve as a textbook for high school. But then another one of my books of poetry was burned in 1972 at the University of El Salvador. It was the university who published it, and it was burned together with other books of other authors. But since about 2 years ago, the Catholic University of El Salvador, that is a Jesuit university, is publishing now the works of all of us. They have published Roque Dalton, and they have published Manuel Argueta, and they have published myself. So now my books are in print in El Salvador.
When you left El Salvador, you didn't. When you left for the first time, you really didn't intend to be in exile. You first left to go to college in America.
That's right. Oh, yes. For many years, my exile was voluntarily because I came to the United States to study. I went to George Washington University. I graduated from George Washington. I married in Washington and had three of my children there. We lived for about 11 years. I lived for 11 years in the United States. And then we went traveling all over, you know. We lived in Latin America and then in Paris, and we made our home later in Mallorca. And then when the revolution, the Sandinista revolution triumphed, we decided to come to Nicaragua to write a book. And it was at that time, at the end of 79, that I went to visit my mother in El Salvador, you know, and I was with her until the first days of January. And since then, I have not been able to come back.
You were born into two very different classes. Your father was a Nicaraguan, and he was a campesino, and he had fought against American Marines. And your mother was from the bourgeois class. She was middle class. There were landowners in her family, yes?
That's right. My father was from a campesino family who owned land, but he himself was a doctor. He was the only one of the 11 children who went to the university, and he was a medical doctor and a rebel, yes. He fought with Benjamin Celedon against the Yankee Marines. And my mother, as you said, she was from the bourgeoisie of El Salvador. And yes, my grandfather was a very, very rich man after he lost all his money, but he was from the oligarch, you know, and he and his brothers were all educated in Europe, in the best universities, in Paris and in Germany and all of that.
Did each side of the family exert a different pull on you?
Exactly, yes. Well, I was very good friend of both of them. They both were amazing people, very progressive people. My mother, in spite of being from the bourgeoisie, she always was thinking of the poor class, of the oppressed, and it hurt her very much to see how the oppressed class was in El Salvador. My father always taught me, you know, he taught me who Sandino was, for instance. I remember I was about 10 years old, and I was one day bathing at the sea when he came very pale, and he said to me, "Come, child, come, Sandino has been assassinated." And then I asked who Sandino was, and he explained to me who Somoza was, and how Somoza, with the North American minister, had, you know, planned the assassination of Sandino. And I remember that I was very shocked that day, and I swore that I was going to revenge somehow, I didn't know how, Sandino's death.
Gee, I wonder what you had in mind when you were young, what you were thinking of doing.
That's right. I was only 10 years old. I don't know what I had in mind. Probably writing.
You know, I know that when you were a child growing up in El Salvador, that there was a peasant uprising, and the National Guard brought prisoners to a fortress which was right across the street from your house.
Right, yes.
Did you look out the window and see prisoners
being
marched
another, by? Yes, that was another thing, Terry, that marked me very, very much. It was, as you said, my bedroom was right in front of the National Guard. And as a child, my brother and I, as children, you know, we would go to the window to see the street, and we saw these campesinos being brought there, you know, with their hands tied in the behind. And we saw, as children, how this Coronel Salinas would slap their faces. And my father, again, was so wonderful, because one time he came out from his clinic, you know, and he was in rage, and he told the colonel, "Colonel, you never do something like that. That's being a coward, to slap a man when he cannot defend himself." And I remember my heart jumped, and I thought, this is it. My father is going to be killed. But no, nothing happened.
Did seeing that scare you, or did it more make you angry and want to take action?
It made me scared, and it made me anger at the same time. And I was a very curious child at the time, and I knew something terrible was happening in El Salvador. And I remember I wanted to listen to all the conversations that the grown-ups were having. And I have a beautiful nanny that was an Indian woman from Izalco, one of the places, the place where the great massacre took place, you know, where Martinez assassinated 30,000 peasants and Indians. And so my nanny was so, so sad. And she would tell me that practically all the men in Izalco were killed because Martinez thought that all the Indians were communists, and he wanted to, you know, just completely mop them out. And so my nanny told me, you know, how so many of her relatives, the main relatives, would dress as women in order to flee this little town of Izalco and go somewhere else. And they decided not even to talk their language, that was the Nahuatl, anymore, because they were very much afraid of the persecution and that they were going to be killed. So I grew up with all of that bottle inside me. And one day, all of these souvenirs came to the surface, and I started writing about them.
This is when you were in America that you started writing?
Let me see where I was. I was in Europe.
So this was after you had graduated from college then?
That's right. When I was in America, I was a very lyrical, subjective poet, very individualistic, thinking about myself only and about my happinesses and about my sadness and about my interior landscape, you know? And it was it was in about 1962 when we moved to Paris at the end of 62 that I started writing about El Salvador.
So tell me again, what brought all this to the surface? What brought the anger to the surface and the desire to write about El Salvador?
You know what I think it brought it out? I think it was because I thought that all of these dictatorships in Central America were inevitable, that they were going to go on, that nobody could stop them, you know, could do anything to change them. And so I started being a little blasé, I guess, about that, and just writing about myself and being preoccupied with myself. But then in 1959, the Cuban Revolution took place. And I was amazed about that, that a little country that was only 90 miles away from the United States could do that. And then in 62, as you recall, it was the invasion of the Bay of Pigs. And I was amazed again to see that, yes, that the Cubans were defending what they had. And so then I started being more aware of what was going around me in my countries, in my region. And then all of a sudden, all of these souvenirs that were inside me started being an obsession. And I kept talking and talking to my husband about my obsessions. And he was the one who told me, "Look, you have to write about that, otherwise you'll be sick." And that's when we realized, you know, that we had to write this novel, and we wrote this novel of Ashes of Izalco, that is a historical novel about the 1932 event, and nobody had written about that at all, because Martinez, you know, the dictator that did this massacre, had all of the newspaper of the epoch burned so that nobody would have anything. Nobody would write about that. And in the school books, it only says, oh, yes, in 1932, we had sort of a revolution that was, that was not successful, and that was all. And so we were the first ones who wrote about that, and it was based only in my souvenirs and in three little clippings that my father kept, and that's it.
You had mentioned before that your mother's side of the family was wealthy and that they supported the oligarchy. When you started writing poems that spoke out against the military in El Salvador, was your mother's side of the family angry with you? Did they think that you were a traitor to them?
Well, yes, especially when Cenizas, Ashes of Izalco was published, the novel, my mother's side of the family didn't like it at all. As a matter of fact, there were some distant aunts that, as the book was published first in Spain, and they asked for many books, and then they burned them, and they told me, they didn't even spoke to me anymore, and they said I was a traitor. I am still considered by some members of my family a traitor to my class, and they don't like me at all.
Did that feeling that your family was going to consider you a traitor ever make you think twice about writing this poetry?
No, not at all. The only thing was my parents, and I remember I sent my parents the book of Ashes of Izalco, and I always, when they were alive, showed them my poems, and I always said, if there is something that you don't like, that you think is going to hurt you, I am not going to publish, just to my parents. And my parents said, don't be silly, both my mother and my father, go on saying what you have to say. And I am very grateful to them for that.
My guest is exiled Salvadoran poet Claribel Alegría, and her new book is called Luisa in Reality Land. We're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Salvadoran poet Claribel Alegría is my guest. Well, you had mentioned that you started writing political poetry when you were living in Paris. Did that make you want to return to El Salvador again?
Very much. I want to return to El Salvador very much. And I am very optimistic, and it's going to be probably still a long war. I don't know. I hope it's shorter than longer. But of course, I want to return. I am very lucky because I live most of the time now in Managua. And Managua is also Nicaragua is also my motherland. And I don't feel exiled. This is the same people, and I feel very lucky to live there. But of course I want to return. There are some certain smells. There are certain way of the people talking. There are certain faces that I remember, certain trees, certain colors that I think that are only unique in El Salvador, and I want to return and I want to talk to my people, yes.
Is there a certain amount of guilt that you felt before you moved back to Latin America? Guilt that you weren't there with the people who were fighting against the military and that you were writing about it from such a faraway distance where you could be more comfortable? I've heard a lot of exiles talk about something called exile guilt.
You are very perceptive, Terry. Exactly. I had the terrible guilt, especially when I was living in Mallorca. Mallorca, as you know, is a paradise. It's very beautiful. And we were living in a beautiful town, a small town with lots of artists, painters, poets, everything. And I said this is a paradise, but I felt a terrible guilt because I was not doing anything from my people. I have a poem that is called My Paradise of Mallorca, and I said that yes, it's a paradise, but that every night that paradise is people with phantoms, and the phantoms were the phantoms of my guilt. So my guilt was so big, really, that when the Sandinista revolution triumphed, then my husband told me just 2 or 3 days before Somoza fled. My husband told me, all right, you know, you have been talking so much about this guilt. Let's go to Nicaragua then. Let's go to Nicaragua and write a book about Nicaragua. How about that? And I was so happy. And 6 weeks later, we came to Nicaragua and we lived there for 6 months and we interviewed lots of people from, you know, comandantes and peasants and workers and everything. And we wrote this book that was published in Mexico that is called the Sandinista Revolution.
In some of your poems, you write about friends of yours who were killed or tortured.
Yes.
or maimed. And it reminded me of something that you write that your mother told you when you were young. Your mother had told you that you always needed to name the dead in your prayers so that they
Yes.
would be remembered and so that they would be able to escape from limbo. In a way, your poetry reminds me of that, of like naming the dead, of keeping them alive, of...
That's right. You are completely right. That litanies that I don't do anymore, you know, that I said in Luisa in Reality Land, in this. But I always remember my dead. But there are so many there, so many, that as I said in this poem that I just read, sometimes I feel like I am a cemetery and that my dead friends are even more than my friends that are still alive, that there are more on the other side. That on this side, and I always like to remember them. And I guess that's the thing, as you said, from my childhood, I don't ever want them to be forgotten.
Is it easier for you to write now that you're living most of the time in Nicaragua and that you're closer to your home?
Yes, it's very easy for me to write in Nicaragua, very easy. And I am all the time motivated by many things. Yes. I am in a very good period of writing now. I don't have a block like I had for many, many, many times when I was living in Europe, for instance, a writer's block.
Can I ask you to read another poem for us?
Yes, of course. And this poem also I wrote when I was in Mallorca. It's called Toward the Jurassic Age. Someone brought them to Palma, the size of an iguana. They ate insects and rats. The climate was favorable. They started to grow. They left rats for chickens and dogs. They ate more than one lonely donkey. Children turned loose on the streets. The gutters were clogged as they fled to the fields. They ate cows, sheep, and kept growing. They tore down walls. They chewed up olive trees. They scratched their backs on jutting rocks until landslides blocked the roads. They leapt over the landslides, and now they are in Valdemosa. They killed the village doctor, and, frightened, the people hid. There are herbivores and carnivores among them. The carnivores know one another by the military caps that crown their crests. But both are harmful. They devour plantations and carry fleece the size of supper plates. They scratch against walls until houses tumble. They are now in Valdemosa and can only be killed by rockets dropped from planes. But no one can stand the stench when one of them dies. The people protest that it is impossible to bury them.
You know, there are so many poets like yourself whose work is considered very dangerous in El Salvador. And I think it's almost difficult for North Americans to understand the power that poetry has in Latin American countries. Because I think in the United States that poetry has become relegated to what's considered to be a kind of obscure art, you know?
Yes. Yes, that's right. You know, for instance, about 4 years ago, my husband and I had an anthology of North American poets, and they started from Mark Strand, the young ones, Mark Strand, and ended with Caroline Forche. And when we finished the anthology, there were great poets, great poetry there. But we thought, after reading it all, my goodness, this is fantastic poetry, but this, with the exceptions of the black poets and some of the women poets, they were very individualistic poetry, sort of like a closed-room poetry, see? I guess it's because North American poets don't have so much to fight against, I don't know. And in Latin America, it is impossible that you have certain sensitivity. For instance, in Central America, and a poet is supposed to have sensitivity, you are not aware of what happened right there all around you. And so that is reflected in the poetry. I think that's it.
Was it hard for you to figure out for a while what kind of poetry you could write that would make an impact?
No, and I never thought about that, Terry, really, to tell you the truth. As a matter of fact, I never go and write, let's say, a poem that is going to be a political poem or a protest poem, never, because I have such an awe for poetry, and I think poetry cannot deliberately be used for anything. But as I say, and then I realized that what I had to do was to write testimonies. And we have written, my husband and I, a number of testimonial books together. But as I said, I always, when I write poetry under the spur of obsession. And my obsession right now is my people in Central America, what is happening to them. And that's why it does reflect. But I always say my poems, I don't consider them political. I consider them love poems for my people.
You still write, I think, most of your poems in Spanish.
Yes, and all of them.
And then
oh, yes, I never could write in any other language but Spanish. But my husband translates my poetry now.
How does that work out? You know English, so you can read the translations that he's written.
That's right.
It's very difficult, I think, to translate poetry to another language and get both the texture and the meaning.
Very, very difficult. I think it's a great challenge. I have translated poetry myself from English to Spanish, and I think no matter how good the translations are, there is something that is missing, like the odor, the aroma of the poem sometimes escapes. But I really think that I've been very fortunate because both my translators, Caroline Forche and my husband, Bob Flakel, have been great translations. They really are. And I have worked with them in translating my poetry.
I wonder what it's like when you read those poems in English, because the rhythms are going to be so different than the ones that you
wrote. That's right. It's a little different, but they have done beautiful things. They have captivated, I don't know how you said, capture. They have captured, you know, the aroma. Yes.
So we only have about a minute left, but I'd be interested in hearing, now that you're living in Nicaragua, do you do a lot of poetry readings there? Is your poetry heard a lot or read a lot by people there?
Yes, very much. You know, Nicaragua is a land of poets. And, well, all the time they are having poetry readings all over the country. It's so beautiful. You know, we go, for instance, to very small towns, and there is announced that poets, that there's going to be readings, and we go in groups or sometimes alone, and the people are already there in the plazas, under the sun, sometimes under the rain, waiting for the poets, you know, and we go there and we read to them. Oh, many, many readings. Yes, Nicaraguans love poetry. It's a land of poets.
Well, Claribel Alegría, I want to thank you very much for reading some of your poems and for talking with us about your life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Claribel Alegría's memoir about her childhood is titled Luisa in Reality Land. Her new book of poetry, Woman of the River, is published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll look back at the days when the studios ruled the film industry. My guest will be Thomas Schatz, whose new book, The Genius of the System, looks into the inner workings of the Hollywood studio system from the 1920s to the 50s. I hope you can join us. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Drag strip shocks, piston hard drama, and rock and roll love. That was the ad copy for the film Hot Rod Rumble. Michael Barson reprints the advertising posters from the great teen exploitation films in his new book, Lost, Lonely, and Vicious. Coming up, we talk about the forgotten B films of the 50s. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the debut album of Marimelin, a marimba and violin duo. And critic at large Laurie Stone surveys the work of comic and actress Whoopi Goldberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Confirmation hearings for Defense Secretary-designate John Tower ended today with an unusual disclaimer by a cabinet nominee. Tower addressed charges that he drinks too much. Details from NPR's David Mulbus.
Committee Chairman Sam Nunn put the question squarely to Tower. Do you have a problem with alcohol?
I have none, Senator. I'm a man of some discipline.
Tower said there should be zero tolerance of anyone in a sensitive government position who has an alcohol problem. And he said it's essential that the Secretary of Defense be capable of exercising his duties at all times. Rumors about Tower's drinking habits have plagued his nomination from the start, and they spilled over into the confirmation process yesterday when conservative activist Paul Weyrich said he had seen Tower intoxicated on a number of occasions. But today, the senators seem satisfied with Tower's answers. Republican Malcolm Wallop of Wyoming said Tower's current lifestyle is pretty modest. When reporters asked about Tower's past lifestyle, Wallop said, "History is history." The committee's expected to approve the Tower nomination tomorrow. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
The Associated Press reports tonight that HUD Secretary-designate Jack Kemp accepted more than the legal limit in speaking fees since leaving Congress. The AP says the former Buffalo, New York representative has already agreed to return $16,000 in fees and to forego another $39,400 in fees not yet received. A Senate aide reportedly said Kemp had mistakenly believed that the money received after leaving Congress did not apply to limits imposed under House rules. A Senate committee is scheduled to vote tomorrow on Kemp's nomination to head the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The Environmental Protection Agency's top pesticide official said today that new studies suggest the controversial chemical farmers spray on apples, called Alar, is a potent cancer-causing chemical. But he said despite the evidence, EPA will not ban the chemical for at least a few more years. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports.
Alar first caused a big flap back in 1985 when EPA officials said the chemical causes such rare tumors that farmers should not be allowed to use it. But then an EPA committee of science advisors said the animal cancer studies were flawed, and EPA officials backed off and called for more studies. Now some of those studies are finished, and according to EPA Assistant Administrator Jack Moore, they show an inescapable and direct link between Alar and animal cancer. Moore said agency researchers estimate that hundreds of people could get cancer if they kept eating Alar-contaminated apple products just over the next couple years. But Moore said he doesn't think there's enough evidence to justify banning Alar immediately. He said he wants to wait a few years to see more animal studies, a decision environmental activists immediately attacked. But whatever action EPA takes may be almost irrelevant. Over the last couple years, most of the nation's major supermarket chains and apple processors have refused to buy any apples treated with Alar, just to be on the safe side. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Washington.
The judge in the Iran-Contra trial of Oliver North today threatened to hold a television reporter in contempt of court for what the judge said was a deliberate attempt to obstruct jury selection. U.S. District Judge Gerhard Gesell said he might charge ABC's Tim O'Brien with contempt for airing North's 1987 congressional testimony in his story about the difficulties in selecting a trial jury. Four more potential jurors were picked today. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir today presented and the PLO rejected a two-stage peace plan for the occupied territories. Under Shamir's plan, Israeli troops would withdraw from some cities in the territories if Palestinians accept autonomy as a step toward solving the Arab-Israeli conflict. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 4 points to close at 2338.21. Declines and advances were about even on volume of 215 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The marimba and the violin may sound like strange bedfellows, but classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of a new album of contemporary music written for them. The performing duo, the album, and the first piece of music on it all take their name from this unusual combination, marimbalin.
"You gotta get a gimmick," sings the stripper in Gypsy, who bumps it while playing a trumpet. 3 years ago, two gifted musicians, marimba player Nancy Zeltzman and violinist Sharon Leventhal, discovered they had the best possible gimmick. They sounded terrific together. So they became Marimbalin, and their first album has just been released by GM Recordings. This is an exciting small label founded by composer-conductor Gunther Schuller, primarily to showcase contemporary and other neglected American music. I wouldn't be surprised if Marimbalin became GM's biggest hit. Here's the beginning of the haunting second movement of Thomas Oboe Lee's Marimbalin. Neither instrument is classical in origin. The marimba was originally an African folk instrument that later became associated with Mexico and Central America, where marimba bands blended folk and popular styles. It didn't become respectable until the 20th century. The violin also had its origins in folk music, but it's been associated with classical music for so long, it was something of a shock when musicians began using it in jazz. Most of the pieces Marimbalin plays seem happily cross-fertilized by both jazz and the classics. Even as classically grounded a piece as Scott Wheeler's Lyric Variations has a distinctly American vernacular feel. Since there isn't a ready-made repertoire for this combination, most of Marimelin's material is written especially for them. The six composers represented here are all in their mid-30s or 40s. Their music has an unpretentious, youthful, often improvisatory sound. Like the piano, the marimba can play both melody and rhythm. A pianist friend pointed out how much easier it is to hear the violin when it's playing with a marimba than to balance it against what he refers to as that big black box. Though the marimba doesn't have nearly the variety of tone a piano has, it sure can shimmer in both leading and supporting roles. And Marimelin is not above doing pieces with other instruments. Tabla and triangle in Robert Aldrich's Three Dance. Oboe and bass clarinet in Les Thimmig's jazzy Blue Fire Crown III. Or horn in the trick mirrors of Amelia Rogers's sonically adventurous Shadow Play. In Somewhere in Maine, composer and jazz pianist Lyle Mays uses electronically synthesized sounds, all derived from the marimba and violin. I hope this appealing team succeeds, but I also hope they don't buy their popularity by emphasizing color and charm over the development of moving and substantial ideas, like another group that sometimes seems to have turned new music itself into a gimmick, the Kronos Quartet. For the moment, though, there's no need to worry. We can just sit back and enjoy this delightful new album.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Marimelin will perform this Sunday evening at the Cambridge Multicultural Arts Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Their debut album is on the GM Recordings label. This is Fresh Air. Blonde Bait, No Time to Be Young, Teenage Caveman, and Juvenile Jungle are some of the forgotten B-films of the 50s. It's hard to see these films now, but you can see the posters that advertise them, reproduced as postcards, in Michael Barson's new book, Lost, Lonely, and Vicious. Barson is a popular culture historian who collects not only movie posters, but also comic books from the 40s, hard-boiled detective pulps, rhythm and blues records, and much more. He told me the kinds of films he wanted to have represented in his new book.
Generally, they're referred to as exploitation films. Many of them are teenage exploitation ones, but all of them combine, I guess you'd say they're all B pictures. They all were not headline pictures when they played, and a lot of them played only in drive-ins.
They all come from the period of 1949 to 1961. I think one of the things about that period is that it's the first time that there was really a teen culture.
Yes, that was just then when you started to see Life magazine running all these alarmist articles about the juvenile delinquency problem in the country. And you had star films like Humphrey Bogart's Knock on Any Door about the same problem. But once it made the headlines, the cheap movie makers rushed into production these kinds of films, and they were made often in 5 or 6 days.
What else was special about the period of 1949 to 61, the period from which you've taken the movie posters?
Well, one of the things that appeals to me about all of these kinds of films is that the element of sex that's in them has to be downplayed and dealt with in a very indirect way, something that seems quaint to us now, 30 years later or more. And it's that approach, you know, it's too late for her to say no, and things like this, which really, it's a treatment that we've lost our innocence long since that day when we could deal with things that way indirectly. Now everything is so direct, and it's lost all of its charm, I think.
I have to say, there's nothing that seems innocent about these movies to me. The movie that you just quoted from, Too Late to Say No, is from Teenage Doll.
Yes.
And the blurb on the poster is, too young to be careful, too tough to care, now it's too late to say no. I mean, that's not not an innocent ad, exactly.
Well,
nor is Hot Rod Rumble with its piston-hard drama.
Well, Terry, I don't know what I can say about the way your mind works. To me, these are very, very innocent.
Oh, they're so insinuating. I mean,
yes.
Isn't that what it's all about?
No, yeah. Of course they are, yes.
It's like super lurid, almost like to compensate for the fact that there was, I mean, there was still the code in the movies.
Oh, there was nothing in these movies,
right.
or in the books or in anything else. It was all sizzle and no steak, and it's really appreciating that sizzle that led me to do this.
Let's talk about some of the different types of movies that you include in Lost, Lonely, and Vicious. There's the prison movies and the girl gang movies. As a matter of fact, we have a clip from the movie Reform School Girl.
Gloria Castillo brings you the dramatic, shocking truth about reform school girls.
Your name's Donna, huh?
That's right.
What's your rap?
Man got killed. Stolen car, and I wouldn't say who did it.
Ross Hunter, a psychologist who tries to help all reform school girls. And Edward Burns, as the kind of a man who is a constant threat to everyone.
I'll figure a way. You better. Man, you better. Or you're fixing to sniff that crazy cyanide.
There's a couple of movies that you have postcards for. There's a Girls in Prison, What Happens to Women Without Men, and Betrayed Women, What Happens Behind the Barrack Walls of the Female Devil's Island. There's always this implicit promise of lesbianism and sadomasochistic sex in the way the ads are written, don't you think?
Oh, yes. And really, I think the whole Girls in Prison thing that is popular with men for that reason. I can't really psychoanalyze the whole culture or even myself, but that's it. However, I saw Girls in Prison, and I can report that there isn't anything like that in the film. So not that they couldn't make a movie with that in it, but it's the innocent period here that I think is funnier.
Let's talk about beatnik movies. We have an excerpt of a trailer here from the film The Beatniks.
These are the beatniks, the defiant young, coming from every walk of life, wrought with suppressed emotions, and mocking the everyday course of modern society, intent on striking back as they wage a battle for their right to be heard.
I love the line that these are the beatniks mocking the everyday course of modern society. That was the big fear that's exploited in these movies, right?
Well, it's that fear that created the headlines for all of these things, you know, kids running wild in the streets. And when you see the Life magazines and the Time magazines' accounts of these things, whether it's beatniks or girls who have to go to reform schools or later the Haight-Ashbury scene in the 60s, it just takes a few years for you to realize, looking back, how ridiculous their account of all that was. But at the time, you know, that's what passes for news.
It must have been great fun to come up with the copy for the posters and for the trailers. Did you ever meet anybody who had the job of writing it?
No, but I want that job. I want to be able to describe Girls on the Loose as trigger tough and ready for anything. I mean, it must have been a blast. Of course, they probably weren't paid anything for thinking up these great lines, but that is really part of the fun with looking at these and enjoying them today.
There were some terrific movies from the 50s that had cameos by rock and roll bands of the time, and some of that footage is really great footage now of people in their prime performing.
Often it's the only good footage we have. You know, although people like Little Richard are still around, many others are not. And that's really the appeal of those. In fact, they're very collectible because many of the great rock stars made their only preserved appearance in some of those movies.
A lot of the movies that you include in Lost, Lonely, and Vicious were B-movies. When they stopped being B-movies, when they stopped basically being double features, did these movies start to die out?
Well, they did, but they're still being made. The difference is that instead of showing up at your local cinema, they're showing up on your home television. You see made-for-TV movies like Katie, Portrait of a Centerfold. These would have been theatrically released movies back in the 40s and 50s. Now there's no market for them at $7 a ticket, so they just show up on TV where you watch them for free.
I think one of the projects you're working on now is digging up Red Scare hysteria literature.
Yes.
What are you looking for exactly?
Well, everybody knows that there was a period called the McCarthy period in American history where, you know, the whole communist menace thing permeated everything. It had a serious side. But on the other hand, if you can step back a little further and just see how insane the whole thing became, where commies were under every desk in every schoolyard and around every corner, it begins to take on some of the more comic proportions. And I'm gathering together materials like, movie posters, of course, from movies like I Was a Communist for the FBI and Red Menace, and my favorite, Zsa Zsa Gabor in The Girl in the Kremlin from 1957. And I'm interested in this because you always see the serious side of it, and there was a serious side to it where, you know, the Hollywood 10 were blackballed and people lost their jobs and so forth. But it's just, again, hard to believe that a nation like ours can just lose its marbles.
Are there any connections to be made between the advertising copy for the teen exploitation movies and the kind of copy that was written during the Red Scare period?
Well, it was the exact same thing, really, Terry, because you probably had the same people making the movies, the same actors acting in them, and the same copywriters writing the copy on the posters. It was just one more headline to exploit. You know, you had John Wayne versus the commies in a movie like Big Jim McClane. You had Mike Hammer, the private eye that Mickey Spillane created, going up against commie gangsters in New York City and in One Lonely Night. And those gangsters supposedly were running around New York with Tommy guns trying to take over the United States. I mean, there is an absurd aspect to it where whatever was really there in the way of some kind of communist menace was just blown so out of proportion that it really is funny today, at least to somebody with my warped sense of humor.
Michael, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Barson's postcard book, Lost, Lonely, and Vicious, is published by Pantheon. Sinister Cinema in Pacifica, California, has released a video of trailers from teen films.
The picture every parent and teenager should see. The story of girls who go too far, too fast. It's the authentic emotional drama of girls in trouble. The gopher broke generation that tries anything.
This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Alex, what are you covering on the show today?
Hi, Terry. You know Senator John Tower, that is former Senator John Tower, now Secretary of Defense designate by President Bush. He's up on Capitol Hill for more hearings today, and we'll have coverage of that. More kind of ethical questions for Mr. Tower about how he might do that job. We'll have a review of the new movie about the life of Karen Carpenter, the singer who died of anorexia. This movie has been made with dolls, Barbie dolls, Ken Barbie dolls, playing the roles of Karen Carpenter and her brother Richard. So, movie reviews and news from Capitol Hill coming up.
Thanks, Alex. That's on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. Whoopi Goldberg has always done characters in her act, like the surfer chick.
And, like, I totally love to surf, okay, because, like, I just love it, you know? And, like, one time, like, you know, like, I was on the beach and, like, these people came up to me and they said, like, are you a valley girl? And I said, no, I'm a surfer, because before there was the mall, there was the ocean, okay?
Goldberg keeps adding new characters to her act and changing the old ones. She started off as a stand-up comic, but now she's better known for her movie roles and benefit performances. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, recently caught Goldberg's new one-woman show, Living on the Edge of Chaos, and she has this review.
Near the end of Whoopi Goldberg's live act, she tells a Hollywood story. She goes to a birthday party for Elizabeth Taylor, wearing her baddest black Levi's. At Taylor's front door, she's told to carry her delivery to the back, and when she finally gets inside, she hears Betty Davis croak, "Who is this Whoopi? She's been in the business 2 minutes." Goldberg imitates Taylor taking a crap like a diva, and she serves up a dead-eye impression of bellowing, self-important Davis, mowing down bystanders with her frustration and disability. Even sweeter, Goldberg never loses sight of her own arriviste absurdity. After hearing Davis's derision, she gets ready to, as she says, kick some old lady ass, but just then Davis turns and says, "Hello, Whoopi." Goldberg clutches her heart and in an awestruck tone responds, "Hello, Miss Davis." The rest of Goldberg's 90-minute set lacks the tooth of this vignette, although the evening isn't without pleasure. Goldberg performs mostly in the character of Fontaine, a black male ex-junkie with progressive politics and a Jewish stand-up mouth. The very presence of Fontaine, with his gruff rasp and street swagger, plays chicken with gender, sexuality, class, and ethnicity. But more time is spent on tired subjects like televangelists and Donna Rice, and although Fontaine offers salutary advice about abortion and decries black anti-Semitism, these views, detached from any dramatic framework, come across lecturish, pedantic. Ever since Goldberg burst on the national scene, she's been searching for contexts that could quicken her gifts. She hasn't locked into them yet. In the monologues that launched her, she proved she could act, but her writing tended to wax pious or slide into clichés. She's fared somewhat better in the action movies she's mostly made. Their formula, but an excitingly brash and original persona, is nonetheless emergent. She has style, leather and scarves, dark glasses and Reeboks, perky dreads that curtain her cheeks. Her voice is melodiously deep, and she doesn't care if she's thought androgynous. Playing spies and detectives, she gets shot at and beaten more than any woman I can think of. She also defends herself and goes on the attack more. She looks out for minorities and women. She demystifies racism, and men never undermine her self-esteem. In Fatal Beauty, she responds to a creep who threatens to rape her by saying, "Heart, be still. You're everything I've ever wanted in a man, a yuppie snotnose in designer jeans." Like Barbara Streisand and Bette Midler, Goldberg asserted her style until it gained mass appeal. But Goldberg cuts a far more deviant figure and must have a harder time finding vehicles. She doesn't yet know her strength. She accepts shabby roles. Her confidence wavers. On stage, her juices don't flow unstintingly until she takes us to where she lives now, Hollywood, where she exults in the bounty of stars and glamour and finds herself alternately snubbed and reaping her comeuppance. Like any immersion, the subject deepens her social comedy and motivates her acting. It's a clue to where she needs to turn next.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Roger Black tells us what makes a magazine reader-friendly. Black is one of today's leading publications designers. He's a former art director of Rolling Stone and the New York Times, and the man who redesigned Newsweek and the San Francisco Examiner. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker returns with the Tucker Top 5, five new songs that he thinks deserve attention, for better or worse. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Lawrence of Arabia that director David Lean intended to make. Despite Lean's objections, several scenes were cut from the original version. Those scenes are restored in the new re-release of the film. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.